We are wrapping up our study, our summer in the book of Judges today. It's been a fun-filled 10 weeks talking about war. Before we do that, in the last month or so, I don't know if you guys know what TED Talks are. You should. TED Talks started a decade or so ago with the simple idea that we want to spread good ideas. And what they did was, they said there's far too many pastors out there that talk for way too long. Let's say what we need to say quicker. And really, it's based on this thing called science. They said that people's attention spans here and now last about at the most 18 minutes. At the most 18 minutes. Last week, I preached for 50 minutes. I don't know what 18 you listened to. I hope it was the good part, right? So about a month ago, I went to my staff and I said, hey, what if, just because I like science and I want people to hear what we say and hear it well, what if I started teaching 18-minute messages? And some of you are thinking, finally. And the other one, one of my staff looked at me and said, I'll quit. I'll just quit right now. And I said, I really appreciate that. But my point with that whole story is sometimes when we try to relate the truths of God into our culture around us, we change how we do it. We don't change the truth of God. We change how we do it. It's called contextualization. Contextualization is the intentional process of communicating the historic gospel and teachings of Jesus in contemporary cultural forms. It's hopefully something we wrestle with all the time. How do we tell the story of Jesus in a way that people hear the story of Jesus while not changing the person of Jesus? 18-minute messages would be one of those things. You might not have it be your preference, but it might be a way that people hear. I think about all the different forms of worship that our society takes. For example, the guy that was here before, Andy Sandy, left to start a cowboy church in Dallas. Apparently, you can worship Jesus with country music. Who would have thought? Not my preference, but still good. God is still God. It's a way of saying the gospel differently so that people hear it while keeping Jesus the same. It's contextualization. And we see it all the time. It's why I'm not wearing a suit up here right now. That offends some people. They're probably not at this church, and that's okay. It's what Paul did in Acts 17 when he's in this crowd of people and he sees an unknown God statue and he says, see that unknown God? I got a name for that God. Let me tell you about Jesus. It's contextualization. We don't change the nature or the character of God, but we do change how we say who Jesus is so that different people hear it, because God created difference and it's good. Church shouldn't look the same way for all people all time, because God created a diverse people group. And as we enter into and embrace diversity, what that does is it paints a picture of a bigger God than one preference. But the flip side of that, when contextualization goes too far, we have something called syncretism. Syncretism is the reconciliation or fusion of differing systems of belief. Syncretism is what happens when you change the message of God to fit what the people want the message of God to be. Syncretism is prosperity gospel, when we teach a message from the scripture that God's good is your best good, that God's about you and not him. Syncretism is what happens when we teach principles of a karmic God. If you love God the right way, God will bless you. If you don't love God the right way, you have it coming to you. There is no grace allowed in that model of God. We change the nature and the very character of God to fit what we want God to be. Syncretism is when we go too far with contextualization. And it's usually driven by the whims of people. One commentator said, therein lies the problem, for syncretism relies on the whim of man, not the standard of scripture. There was a French revolutionist in 1848, and he was leading the French Revolution of 1848, and he was talking about the French people. And I love this quote. It's later quoted by Kennedy in a stump speech in 1960 in Illinois. Ledru Rollin said, there go my people. I must find out where they're going so I can lead them. That's syncretism, right? They're going that way. That must be where God is. Let's go. It fits the people's wants and desires and needs, not the character of God. And the danger there is, when we change the message, we're not just changing the nuts and bolts or the facts. We're literally changing the very nature of the God we say we believe in. And when we do that, he doesn't become the God that we say we believe in anymore. If we change the character and the nature of God, then no longer is he this God anymore that we ascribe to. It's dangerous. And really, why I bring this up is that's the book of Judges. The book of Judges is generations of compromise. The book of Judges is far more compromised, that went well beyond contextualization to fit the purposes of the men and women that were there. And we've seen it. And this is our last week in the book. And so what we're going to do is, in the book of Judges, there are two epilogues or ending narratives. One is in 17 and 18. That's where we are today. The other one is 19 through 21. You can read that at home. And what happens is there are these two stories. And it's not really clear where it fits in the 300-year Judges period. Most people put this at a later date towards the end. But the point of our story and the themes that come out of it is quite simply, this is where compromise, this is where syncretism gets you in the end. After hundreds of years and generations of people picking and choosing what kind of God they wanted to follow based on the different religions and gods and Baals and Asherahs around them, and then interposing those with the God of the scriptures, they come to this place. They come to this place where now the God they worship doesn't necessarily look so much like the God of the Bible anymore. And the question we have is, where does that lead us in the end? Because today we have four people we're looking at in our two chapters. The first chapter is about a single family. The other one's about an entire tribe. And it really asks the question, what happens if we compromise the character of God to fit what we want to be true? So let's start in chapter 17. Chapter 17, verse 1. I'm just going to read verse 1 through 4. And then we're going to come back and talk about the different characters. Verse 1. There was a man named Micah from the Ephraimite hill country. He said to his mother, "You know the 1,100 pieces of silver which were stolen from you, about which I heard you pronounce a curse? Look here, I have the silver. I stole it, but now I'm giving it back to you. Happy Mother's Day." His mother said, "May the Lord reward you, my son." When he gave back his mother the 1,100 pieces of silver, his mother said, "I solemnly dedicate this silver to the Lord. It will be for my son's benefit. We'll use it to make a carved image and a metal image." Verse 4. When he gave the silver back to his mother, she took 200 pieces of silver to a silversmith who made them into a carved image and into a metal image. She then put them in Micah's house. So let's talk about the mom first. What we're seeing is people picking and choosing what they want to be true about God and forming this new version of who he is. And so the mother stands out to me in this text for a couple reasons. One is, if you read verse 3, she says, when he gave back the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother, she said, and I love this quote, "I solemnly dedicate this silver to the Lord. It will be for my son's benefit. Let's make some images." And so I think sometimes when we approach the idea that we're going to change the very nature and character of God to fit our purposes, wants, desires, and preferences, we think it's dramatic. We think it's black and white, and we think it happens because we know it happens. I feel for this mom here. I feel for this mom because she said, "This is the God that I know. And when I give this silver, when I vow and dedicate this silver to God, like God wants more silver, when I dedicate this silver to God and use it to make an image, this is the best good for my son." And that to me is really sad. She'd gotten to the point after generations and generations that her best good didn't look like God's best good anymore, because she fundamentally didn't understand who he was anymore. She didn't get that that's not what God wanted. I love the idea that it says in the text that she dedicated the silver to the Lord. Because we're coming off of a couple weeks in Samson where Samson's parents dedicated him to God, but it looked entirely different. It was less to do about stuff and more to do about who he was going to become, his character, his purpose. And so she says, and this is the one that breaks my heart in the end, that it will be for my son's benefit. We'll use it to make a carved image and a metal image. Because here's the deal. I really thought she was helping her kid. And sometimes we change the character of God to fit our wants, preferences, and desires, and it's not quick. It's a slow process, and we don't realize it happens. We don't realize that the good that we're fighting for isn't necessarily good for the people we love. I was at brunch yesterday, and I was with some friends of mine who just had a kid 4 months ago. A baby girl named Joey. They live a couple blocks away. My wife has been best friends with this girl for a decade or so, if not longer. And they were talking about, I guess all we talk about now is our newborn kids and if they're going to sleep. That's it. That's our biggest fear. Please, oh God, let them sleep. Please, oh God, let them sleep. That's it, right? So we're talking about how we deal with sleep and how we deal with lack of sleep. And I guess at 4 months, this is a known thing, kids make a decision to hate their parents again and regress in the sleep cycle. Like for the first 4 months, they hit this beautiful land of I sleep for 3 to 5 hours increments. And then they get to 4 months. And literally what happens is they start to hit the deeper levels of sleep and it wakes them up. And so they were just talking about how hard it is because their kid won't sleep right now and how they're really tired all the time. And he looked up and he said, you know, have you ever heard of shaken baby syndrome? Right? He said, some people are like, yes. He said, I would never, ever shake my baby, but I can see why people do it, right? Just because you'll do anything to make this baby calm down because she needs sleep too. And so they got me thinking about ways that we prescribed good that might not be good. And in 48, I believe, in the 1840s, somewhere in there, there was something called soothing syrup. Look at that graphic, by the way. Something called soothing syrup, right? This was used for about 90 years. It finally got pulled from the shelves in 1938. And literally, one article from back then said it's an indispensable aid to mothers and child care workers. And they used it for everything. If they had a toothache, if they wouldn't sleep, if they were being fussy, you gave your kid this soothing aid, and they just stopped crying. In 1910, the New York Times wrote an article and said, this is why soothing aid, and I quote, has 65 milligrams of morphine per fluid ounce, chloroform, codeine, heroin, powdered opium, and cannabis, right? Yeah. We were prescribing this for 60 years. And they said, there's a reason why it knocks your kid out. I could imagine all the moms being like, oh my gosh, you're poisoning your child, right? But you thought it was their best good. For years, finally got pulled from the shelf in 1938. It's this idea that oftentimes we dichotomize idolatry. And we think that it's easy to spot and easy to recognize. But it's not. Sometimes it comes under the guise of this is the best good for my family or the ones I love or me. One theologian said it this way. I think our problem may be that we don't see the stupidity of false religion because we don't see our false religion. Only after we see the forms of false religions, only after we see the forms our false religion takes can we see how stupid it is. Sometimes it's hard to spot. And so the mom said, we're going to make you some graven images. And she said in verse 2, I want to worship the Lord. This is the God of Israel. She said, this is how we do it. I still want to worship the Lord. I just want to look at something. How bad is that? It's a slippery slope down changing the character of God to fit our wants and preferences. And just so we know, God is against that kind of thing. We see in the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or anything or any likeness or anything that is heaven above or that's on earth beneath or that's in the water below. But God doesn't just say not to do it. It says it really, really makes him angry in Deuteronomy 27. Cursed is the one who makes a carved image or metal image, something abhorrent to the Lord, the work of the craftsman, and sets it up in a secret place. Then all the people will say amen. Because here's the problem with carved images, even if we have good intentions, is ultimately what we're trying to do is make God controllable. So, for example, there's a guy named Cristiano Ronaldo. Got a picture of him up here. He is one of the top soccer players of all time. And you can like soccer, not like soccer. You can like this guy, you can not like this guy. But one thing you cannot deny is, I know beauty's in the eye of the beholder, but every beholder, that man he's a good-looking dude, okay? He's just good-looking. It's okay to say that. God is still God. He's a good-looking dude, right? It's kind of known when you do the whole game of why did some people seemingly get more of the gifts than others. He's one of the best athletes in the world. He's worth about $1 billion, and he looks like that. I get a little angry sometimes, but I'm working that out with the Lord. So about a year ago, he's won like the top prize in all of soccer for the best player in the world, I think 5 times, somewhere in there. And about a year ago, they were commissioning a statue of him to go somewhere important, I forget. And this was the statue. Bam, right? That does not look like, there was outrage online. Like people posted pictures of Ronaldo and said, this and this, you have got to do something about this. Some guy really, really messed up, right? And my point is simple. It's when we try to make an image to look to when we worship God, what we're doing is trying to encapsulate the glory of God in something that cannot possibly encapsulate God's glory. We're compromising God's glory so that it can fit something that we can see. And in doing that, we change the very essence and nature of what his glory is in the first place, something that we can't control or stop. So when God says, don't make an image, when God says, don't fashion something, he says it because nothing we can fashion can ever, ever, ever come close to containing and or reminding us and or doing a good job of showing us this is what God looks like. And if we ever think that it can, then we're redefining the character and nature of who God is, even if you have good intentions. And so I said, hey, don't make graven images. But the woman does it. And in doing that, she sacrifices a bit. She changes a bit of the glory of God. But then her son Micah wasn't a good dude either. If you look at verse 1, he stole 1,100 pieces of silver. We're going to see a couple verses later, but essentially you could live off 10 pieces of silver a year. It's a lot of money. He stole it from his mom. And he loves the idea of the images. He loves the idea of creating a shrine. Voltaire said it well. He said, God made man in his own image, and since then man has returned the favor. It's a problem that we have. And so Micah then, if you look at Micah, he says in verse 5, now this man Micah owned a shrine. He made an ephod and some personal idols and hired one of his sons to serve as a priest. In those days, Israel had no king. What it does there, what the text is doing, is telling us about what Micah valued. And if you look at verse 13, he's doing these things because it says, now I know the Lord will make me rich because I have this Levite as my priest. So we have the mom that changed the character of God because she wanted to encapsulate the glory of God, and in doing so changes who God is. And then Micah steps on the scene and says, I know. I know how to win the favor of God. I know how to make God bless me. 1 + 1 = 2. If I have the right idols and I have the right person, if I have a priest in my household, then God can't help but bless me. And so he gets these right idols, this ephod that's talked about in the Old Testament, and he puts it there and says, I have the ephod in the right place. I have this metal image in the right place. I just need a priest. I don't see one around. I'm going to hire my son. Quick note, this is for free. Don't hire family if you can't see yourself firing family, because that's going to cause some conflict in his life. And he says, now that I have these people, God can't help. Surely God will make me rich. He's reducing the worship of God to empty ritual. And in that, you lose what worship's all about. Because he really wanted God to bless him. And he thought the God that he followed, because of years and generations of compromise, not just contextualization, but absolute compromise of the character of God, led him to believe that if he did this and he did this, God would have to bless him. And that's sad, because it changes the nature of what worship is. Because then if you do one and you do one and the answer is not two when you add those together and God doesn't bless you, then what are you left with about God? Either he lies, he can't, or he doesn't care. It's not the nature and character of God and how he works. And if anything is a testament to that, it's the book of Judges, because these people didn't deserve to be saved throughout the entire book, but God kept on doing it. It's a beautiful grace that God is not asking us to do, to check the boxes to earn his merit and favor. When you reduce worship to empty rituals, you forget that God is gracious. And in that, you change the very nature and character of God in our world. And then Micah realizes that he needs a priest, and then introduces us to the third person in our story, verse 7. There was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah. He was a Levite who'd been temporarily residing among the tribe of Judah. The man left the town of Bethlehem in Judah to find another place to live. A couple things about our text here that we need to talk about is when it talks about him being a Levite and why essentially in the end Micah trades up is because God in the Old Testament said, I'm going to divide up the land among the 12 tribes. One of you isn't going to get land. One of you, the descendants of Aaron, Moses' brother, who was the first priest, one of you is going to be dispersed between all of the people. You're going to be dispersed between all of the people because you are my intercessories between the people and me. You are the priests among them. It's what the church is supposed to be now. You show the people anywhere and everywhere that I am with them. And so when it says that he was a Levite, what he's doing, it's really saying that this is a guy from the tribe of the priests. But the problem was that he left where he was. It says in Deuteronomy 18, it says, if a Levite moves from one of your towns anywhere in Israel where he's living and comes in all earnestness to the place the Lord will choose, he may minister in the name of the Lord, his God, like all his fellow Levites who serve in the presence of the Lord. A couple things to note is, one, it says where the Lord chooses, and what we see in our text is, one, this kid chose where he wanted to go because it was better for him. And so he was fundamentally not acting in accordance with God's preference. And then two, it says that he was a young man from Bethlehem. And what we see with that is, in order to be a priest in the tribe of Levi, not all Levites were priests, but all priests were Levites, right? It's like not all Christians are paid to be pastors, but hopefully all paid pastors are Christians. That's a whole nother conversation. But what it's saying there is that he was a young Levite. You had to be at least 25, some theologians think 30, before you could start practicing to be a priest in the temple. And he was younger than that. So we see this Levite, who two things we know about the Levitical tribe. One is you had to be 25, 30. He wasn't. Two is God chose your place. You didn't choose your own. And he decides both those don't apply to him because it wasn't for his benefit. And so if you keep reading in our text, it says in verse, pick it up in verse 9, Micah said to him, where do you come from? He replied, I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah. I'm looking for a new place to live. Micah said to him, stay with me, become my advisor and priest, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver per year, plus clothes and food. So the man became his priest and lived in Micah's house. So Micah reduced the worship of God to empty ritual, but the Levite sacrifices God's ethics for his own good. He ignored the standards God set up so he could benefit from it. He didn't worship God, he used God to get what he wanted. And fundamentally, over time, we see the influence from the different tribes around him where God is for your good, not his good, weighed in on this kid. And he says, yeah, this is good for me. God must want this because I want this. Even though there's all these other things in place, it doesn't matter. My good is God's good. And we start to see people change the very nature and character of who God is. And why they do it, look at verse 6. Verse 6 is repeated 3-4 different times in the two epilogues. And why all this stuff is happening is it says, in those days Israel had no king. Israel did what he thought was right in his own eyes. When it says king there, it doesn't mean the problem would be solved if they did. Little Old Testament history. When God set up Israel in the first place, he did so saying to them, you're going to be different. You're not going to have a king because you have me. And that's an upgrade. He said, we're going to have what's called a theocracy. I'm running the show and you got to trust me in this. And I will lead your country and guide your country if you follow my ways. If you don't, it's not going to end well. Welcome to the book of Judges and the rest of the Old Testament. But slowly but surely, what the people did was they wanted a king. And what this means isn't that they needed a king to save them. What it means is kings stood for some kind of objective standard for good, and they implemented that. They lost objectivity in their reference for what good was. Their moral compass didn't point north anymore. If you think of the feudal system in the Middle Ages, it's the same kind of thing. You would sign on to live under this lord. And when you'd live under this lord, he would set the rules, you would follow the rules, and if you did that, anybody that tried to attack you or your family, he would stand up for you and fight them away. It's this idea that he set the standard for good in his kingdom, in his kind of whatever his city was. And as long as you lived in that, there was an objective standard for good, or you could go out on your own. The book of Judges at the end is a story about, it's the culmination of when everybody defines good for their own good and what happens. And essentially, when you have no objective standards for morality, you devolve into chaos. We've all read Lord of the Flies. We've all seen what happens if you leave four-year-olds in a room without any adult supervision. You come back and somebody's eating all the crayons and a kid's crying in the corner, right? And so what he's saying is why all this is happening in this chapter and the next chapter and the three after that is because they lost sight of what the objective standard for good was that God laid out. And nobody was enforcing it, whether it be a judge or a king. And it wasn't just them that it happened with. It was also not just his one family, but an entire tribe. And that's when we get into chapter 18. So look with me in chapter 18. Let's read the first four verses. In those days, Israel had no king. And in those days, the Danite tribe was looking for a place to settle. Because at that time, they didn't have a place to call their own among the tribes of Israel. The Danites set out from their whole tribe 5 representatives, capable men from Zorah and Eshtatol, to spy out the land and explore it. They said to them, go and explore the land. They came to the Ephraimite hill country and spent the night at Micah's house. Let's stop there for a sec. So we have a new character in our story. We have the entire tribe of Dan. And it says, in those days Israel had no king, and the Danite tribe was looking for a place to settle, because at that time they didn't have a place to call their own. Okay, that's just an outright kind of lie. So if you remember, from the very beginning of our study in the book of Judges, the tone at the very beginning was a happy one. God had finally, after 450-ish years, after delivering from Egypt, after bringing his people here, after using Pharaoh, after using different prophets and Moses and Aaron and now Joshua, he was finally delivering on the promise that he made hundreds of years ago. What a beautiful sight. And so Joshua said, if you guys follow in the ways of God like my family's going to, this is going to be good for you. And Judges chapter 1 lays out, he kind of gets with the tribe together. And he says, hey, let me get the leaders of the tribes. Let me tell you where we're going to go. So he says, Naphtali, you're going to go here. And Joseph, you're going to go here. And Dan, you're going to go here. Here is your parcel, your plot of land for your people. Go. Kick out the Canaanites because they're going to cause you not to love God anymore, which we've seen, and take the land. So when Dan says, we don't have a place to call our own, it wasn't because God didn't give them one. It was because they didn't obey God in the first place. We see it in chapter 1. It says, the Amorites forced the people of Dan to live in the hill country. They didn't allow them to live in the coastal plain. The people of Dan had a place to live that God set aside for them. They didn't live in it because they didn't live in to God's decrees and commands. They didn't obey. And so their problem is their own, is my point. But they don't have a place to stay yet. And so they say, let's go send some spies. Let's just go send some spies and find a place to live. And so in verse 3, we'll pick it up. As they approached Micah's house, they recognized the accent of the young Levite. So they stopped there and said to him, who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What is your business here? He told them what Micah had done for him, saying, he hired me and I became a priest. Okay. If you're a practicing Jewish person and you come up to a priest and you say, why are you here? And he says, because I'm getting paid. That's not a good priest. And at the very least, they should have had a stern talking to. At the most, they should have just stoned the kid. But instead, their actions showed what they wanted from God. It says in verse 5, seek a divine oracle for us so we can know if we'll be successful on our mission. So instead of saying this is not God's design for the Levites, they say, man, we need to figure out if God has for us what we want. Really interesting note in our text here is the name Dan in the Hebrew is very close to the Hebrew word for justice. And actually in Genesis 49, it says the people's role in the tribe of Dan for the whole people of Israel, their role is to judge all the other tribes. It says in 49:16, Dan will judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. They had different roles. And Dan, the people of Dan, were supposed to stand up for God's justice and his righteousness and his goodness. God already gave them a portion, a plot of land. And so they come to Micah. They see the Levite, the paid priest that shouldn't have been a priest in the first place because his good is better than God's design. And he says, tell us if we're going to succeed. And because his good is better than God's design, he answers how you think he'd answer to these people that have a lot of stuff. He said in verse 6, or in the end of verse 5, seek a divine oracle so we can know if we'll be successful. Verse 6, the priest said to them, go with confidence. The Lord will be with you on your mission. And so what we see is kind of a devolving view of the character of God. That his glory isn't big enough anymore. That you can buy his affection by empty ritual. That your good is better than his design. And then finally, that his view of justice is whatever you want it to be. Tim Keller said it well. I love this quote. He said, if your God never disagrees with you, you might be worshiping an idealized version of yourself. That's kind of what we're finding out as the story gets deeper and deeper. And then in verse 7, so the five men journeyed on to Laish. They noticed that the people there were living securely like the Sidonians do, undisturbed and unsuspecting. Let me summarize a bit for you. It says undisturbed and unsuspecting there. And really what it's doing is it's painting a picture of an innocent people. And throughout the book of Judges, the Canaanites haven't been the heroes in the story. They've been the villains. They've been the people representing the sin that Israel wasn't supposed to commit. That at every turn was trying to lure Israel from their God, not in this story. And this story kind of put that narrative aside of the Canaanites, and the author paints them in this really innocent, unsuspecting, kind of quaint, quiet, leave them alone, they're not doing anything wrong kind of picture. And what he does is he paints the tribe of Dan as this me first, inverted view of justice, seeking out what I want at the cost and the expense of others group. When it says that they were unsuspecting, I literally get the picture because the text paints this of my family farm in Iowa that we've talked about. It's in the middle of the middle of the middle of nowhere in Iowa. People are born and raised in Iowa and they don't know it exists. And you drive through this town that was built in a time long, long ago and it hasn't changed at all. And as you drive through it, as I took my wife there last year, you believe and you know that the outside forces haven't gotten here yet. Twitter has not landed in Keswick, Iowa yet, you know? And why is because the Laotians, they had this mountain range that separated them from the people that controlled them, the Sidonians. And the Sidonians were seafaring people, and they were fighting other battles on the other side of the land next to the ocean, and they kind of forgot these people existed in some way. And they didn't really care. They just knew they controlled them, and so they let this little tribe of people do what they wanted, when they wanted, as long as they didn't cause trouble. They were an innocent people. It's like an adult picking on a kid. And so in verse 7, it says that they had this unsuspecting people. The end of verse 7, there was no conqueror that was troubling them in any way. Skip down to verse 9. The spies come back, and the people say, how'd it go? And they say in verse 9, come on, let's attack them, for we saw their land, and it is very good. You seem lethargic, but don't hesitate to invade and conquer the land. It's this big bully system because they're redefining God's justice when they should have stood for it. It says in verse 10, when you invade, you will encounter an unsuspecting people. The land is wide. It says God is handing it over to you, a place that lacks nothing and has nothing bad on earth. What we see in our text is them painting a picture that this is God's design for them because they want it to be. And they use some phrasing there that's really interesting. They said in verse 9 and 10, enter and possess the land, and then a little farther down, God has given it into your hands. That is the same language that was used when Joshua said, go possess the land. It's the same words. So they heard the same chants, and they said, clearly this has to be God because the words are the same. Just like he said to possess the land 200 years ago, he's saying, do it again. He is with us, as they ignored their call, as they ignored God's first purposes, as they ignored what Joshua told them to do in the first part of their story together. They were supposed to stand for justice and they didn't. Because slowly but surely they're changing the character of God to fit their good over generation and generation and generation. So let me sum up the next little bit for you. So they gather 600 people and they start to go out. They start to go out and attack the people. And as they're going out to attack the people, they stop by the house of Micah again. And we're going to start to see now is kind of how all these things end for the characters in our story. How the ways they've chosen to follow God essentially is going to come back on them and they're going to kind of reap the consequences of the God they chose to follow. And so they come back and they find the house of Micah and they find the Levite. Go with me to verse 18. They broke into Micah's house and they stole the carved image, the ephod, the personal idols, and the metal image. And the priest said to them, what are you doing? So again, this is a people driven by their own desires, not the justice of God. And so they said, you know what we also like? We'd like Micah's stuff. So let's break it and take it. We know it's there. We met him a while back. In verse 19, the priest said, what are you doing? And they said to him, shut up, put your hand over your mouth and come with us. You can be our advisor and priest. They just take what they want. Wouldn't it be better for you to be a priest for a whole Israelite tribe than just for one man's family? And the priest, who's always conditioned for his good and not God's design, said, yeah. Verse 20, the priest was happy. He took the ephod, the personal idols, the carved images, and joined the group. I think it's really scary about this, and that's the last you hear from the priest. It's the last you hear from the Levite altogether. What's really scary is the path that he's going down. What's scary is the kind of person that he's following. Because what they're doing is trying to find the best priest they could. So what happens if somebody better comes along? What happens if they find, and they will, what happens if they find somebody else that does the job more? They're not faithful to a people, they're faithful to their purposes. And so what I think matters about this, and kind of a, I think how it fits into how I think about God and in the text is, I think it matters how we call people to follow Jesus. So they're calling them to follow because my tribe is bigger. Hey, come work for me because my church has more resources. hey, come do life with us because it's going to be better for your career. And the problem with that, the very problem with that is I think fundamentally the way we call people to follow Jesus determines the kind of Jesus that they're becoming, if we believe that you look more like Jesus when you follow him. A couple years ago, I had a student who went and visited another church. And he came back and said, Charlie, I went and visited another church. And so I punished him. And I'm kidding. It's a great church, by the way. I really like it. But they do things a little differently. And he said they had this money machine that if you were new, you'd get this money machine and, you know, pick dollar bills out of the air. And they had this, you know, party for new people. And Jason Witten was the speaker. And so I would have converted. Jason Witten was the speaker. And he came back and he said, hey, man, why don't we do stuff like this? They gave away Xboxes and all the good stuff. And I said, that's one way to do ministry. But my fear in that is that the way you call people into Jesus determines the kind of Christ follower they become. So if I call you to follow Jesus because you get more money, then what does that say 2 years from now when you're not? If I call you to follow Jesus because you win things, if I call you to invite your friends because I'm going to give you a PlayStation, then the intrinsic worth isn't Jesus, it's the PlayStation. And so my question as I read through this text that hit me upside the head was, how do we call people to follow Jesus? And does that determine what kind of God they're following? Contextualization or syncretism? And so he, like everybody else that puts their good above God's design, said, sure, let's go. And that's kind of the fate of him, is I'm sure they found somebody else better. It says so in the latter text. They found another guy named Jonathan, who was actually from the line of Moses. So he was a better version of a priest. And that guy led the people of Dan. But then go back to Micah. So Micah, they took all his stuff. And Micah's a 1 + 1 = 2 guy. And if I have 2, God blesses me. So he walks into his house and he sees that not only is his images gone, but you took the Levite. He was the key to God's blessing. And so in verse 24, he goes to the people of Dan as they're leaving, all 600 warriors of them. And there's probably more women and children, so most likely a couple thousand. And he says to him, you stole my gods that I made as well as the priest, and then you went away. He said, what do I have left? How can you have the audacity to say to me, what do you want? Because when he approached, they said, what do you want? In 25, the Danites said to him, don't say another word to us or some very angry men will attack you and your family will die. This is really sad. 26, the Danites went on their way. Then Micah realized they were too strong to resist. He turned around and went home. A couple things about this that strike me. One is he carved an image of God and sat it there and thought that if he did these things, this image of God would protect him. One theologian said, a God who can be made is surely a contradiction in terms, and a God who cannot avoid being pilfered must be not a God indeed. He's reaping the benefit of the God that he chose to follow. Another one said, the young man who first entered the picture as a thief finds himself the victim of grand larceny. So what we see is they're changing the very nature and character of God to what they want him to be. And then when this plays out well, they're left with that God. So fast forward to the people of Dan. Look down at verse 27. It says, now the Danites took what Micah had made, as well as his priest, and came to Laish, where the people were undisturbed and unsuspecting. They struck them down with the sword and burned the city. No one came to their rescue because the city was far from Sidon. And they had no dealings with anyone. All right, so it looks for a second like they're the ones that get out on top. It looks for a second like they are serving their good and their justice is served, not God's. It's a good quote that I like. It said, the degenerating tendency in Israel, it says the Danites worshiped the carved images. I found it. Success is not necessarily a sign of righteousness or an indication that we must be doing something right. It may, in fact, be the opposite. God does not stifle every corrupt thought or scheme of the human heart. And really, the book of Judges is one that takes perspective. Because these things don't just happen in 10 or 20 years. They happen over generations. And God says, I let you guys live outside of my ways for far too long, and now I'm going to bring you back. And so they were free for 40 years, and they were in bondage for 18 years. They were free for 80 years, they were in bondage for 40 years. And so as we bring that perspective to our text, look at verse 30. It says, the Danites worshiped the carved image. Jonathan, descendant of Gershon, son of Moses, and his descendants served as the priests of the Levites, gone for the tribe of Dan until the time of exile. What's really important about this text, what's really important to know, is that Dan became, so fast forward a couple hundred years, You had Israel split because they worshiped different gods and had different kings. You had the northern tribe, the northern kingdom, and the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom actually got taken over by Assyria, and I think it was around 586 BC. And when they got taken over, they got taken over because of the tribe of Dan. Because God said, you worship too many other gods, I'm going to let these other people come and take you over, and I've given you a long rope. And the reason why they did that was the Danite tribe was the epicenter for worship of idols in the northern kingdom of Israel. So when it says that they worshiped those things until the exile, what the writer's telling us is they worshiped those things because it brought about their exile a couple hundred years from now. And what we see throughout all of our story today, what we see through the mom, and what we see through Micah, and what we see through the Levite, and what we see through the tribe of Dan, is eventually, it's the hard truth that what you follow is probably a portrait of your future. Almost every time. What you follow is a portrait of what you're becoming. And it might be today, or tomorrow, or 5 years, or 10 years. What you follow determines kind of how this thing's going to shake out in some ways. And we see it in our text today. Because that's the story of the book of Judges. It's a story of cycles. Of good cycles and bad cycles. Of cycles that made sense. And cycles that sometimes God stepped in to save when he didn't have to. It's a story of cycles. So at the very beginning of this, what we see is Joshua say in chapter 24, at the very end, when they come into the land right before the judges, he says, but for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. And that began a cycle. That began a cycle of people remembering that God was good, of saying, I'm going to bring the message of our Lord to these different places in the world and not compromise who he is. But instead, over time, they began to compromise the character of God to fit their needs, and in the end, it came back on their heads. The Judges is a book of cycles. And just because we've hit it every single week, we're going to end with it this week. Here's the cycle that we've been talking about for the last 10. First, they forgot. And so Joshua said, serve only God. But they forgot that God was good. They forgot, Joshua said, serve him. As they forgot, forgetfulness always led to unfaithfulness. And each week we've said, as you sub in other good for God's good, you begin to be devoted to that good. And so your forgetfulness of who God is and his role in your life leads to other things taking his place. Unfaithfulness always has consequences. So when we're unfaithful to whatever we choose to be unfaithful to, it changes what our tomorrow looks like. And so when you're unfaithful to God, and in this case, when you're unfaithful to worshiping God and you worship the gods of those around you, it looked like those people beating you up because they're bigger than you and God didn't protect you anymore. If I'm unfaithful to my wife, that has consequences. And the grace of God is stopping those consequences, but there becomes a time, like we looked at last week, when God says you have to feel the weight of your action. It's called the wrath of God. But then at the end of this thing, grace never forgets and always rescues. This is the cycle we've talked through week in and week out. But why I love the book of Judges, what my takeaway, there's been a few, have been from this book, is that it's not a book of judgment. It's not a book of God getting mad at his people over and over again. It's a book of God being gracious and stepping in to redeem and restore when his people literally change his character to fit their good, and they did it over generations. And so the cycle in the book of Judges, sure, we have times when he steps in and he says, I need you to come back to me, and you're oppressed for 20 or 30 years. But in between all of those oppressions is God redeeming and restoring. And really the book of Judges is two cycles. It's the one where people forgot, but the other one where people remembered. The other cycle goes like this. First, you remember. As you remember, your faithfulness grows. Your faithfulness leads to a greater trust in God. And then God is good and will rescue. Because really the book of Judges is a story of two cycles. It's remembering the character of God or forgetting it. And those things have consequences either way. And when we talk about these things, when we talk about, that's why we called it stories of repeated rescue, of God stepping in when he didn't have to, we have a choice. What cycle are we engaging in? Because what we follow probably determines or paints a picture of our future. And so my question simply at the end of this whole series that I have loved is, what cycle are we going to step into? One that reminds us that God is faithful and good, or one that forgets? One that reminds us that God can't help but redeem and restore even when we don't deserve it, or one that thinks he never does? Because ultimately, we're going to step into a cycle. We're going to follow a pattern, and we're going to pass that down to kids and grandkids and friends and family. The question is, which one? And as I read through this book, at the end of this whole thing, I kept coming back to one theme. God is so abundantly good when we don't deserve good. And I needed to remember that. And no verse says that to me more than this will end, Exodus chapter 34. The Lord God, is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in loving devotion and truth, maintaining loving devotion to 1,000 generations, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin. I will step into that cycle. I will remember the faithfulness of God. And hopefully as I follow that God who's determined by his character and not my wants and desires, other people see that as well. And we all begin to see a God who steps in and rescues. Let me pray for us. Let's worship. God, I'm so thankful that you're good. I'm so thankful that a book of not so good stories tell the story of a really, really good God. I'm thankful that you're faithful to us. I'm thankful that if we draw close to you, you promise to draw close to us. If we draw close to you and trust that you promise that trust increases and that you fight for us. The book of Judges is the stories of people that weren't good enough or weren't strong enough or weren't big enough or weren't fast enough, but you still stepped in and rescued because they remembered that you were good. I pray that's what we do day in and day out here. I pray that's our cycle at Crossroads. May we tell that story to the people around us. May we remember that you're faithful. May that cause us to worship as we trust you even more with every passing day. I pray these things in the name of Jesus.